This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa. Our regular listeners will notice that we were preempted by NPR's Democratic Convention coverage the first Wednesday of September, so we're glad you tuned in for tonight's rescheduled show, since it celebrates the upcoming Sonoma County Book Festival. This free event happens in and around Santa Rosa's Courtyard Square all day Saturday, September 22nd. Word by Word highlights this literary event by having a conversation with Petaluma author, teacher, and stage director Amanda McTighe about her Blue Ridge Mountains debut novel entitled Going to Solace. And for something completely different, we have a brief talk with Ken Weaver, author of the very popular Northern California Craft Beer Guide. Amanda, Ken, and I, and several previous Word by Word guests, are part of this year's Sonoma County Book Festival. Amanda McTighe, she hails from a long line of talkers. Her daddy's people were immigrant Irish Catholics who wound up stateside in the Appalachian coal mining country of West Virginia. Her mother's people were Presbyterian preachers from North Carolina's Blue Ridge Mountains. An author, teacher, and stage director, Amanda's children's books and companion CDs are on bookstore shelves. Her written works for the theater have been seen on stages ranging from community playhouses to the likes of Juilliard, Carnegie Hall, the Minnesota Opera, and inaugurating Sonoma County's Green Music Center. Amanda, I want to welcome you to Word by Word. Going to Solace is much more than just the title for your book. It's a singular place, a destination, and a state of being all rolled into one. So tell us about Solace.
How lovely to have someone say that to me right off the top. Well, Solace in this book, we are in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. We're in a fictional place.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1980.
I looked it up. I couldn't find it.
Yeah. If you did some cross-referencing to the map at the beginning of the book, you might find the mountains I used for that map. But otherwise, I used fictional town names. Nevertheless, it's a lot like the area where I grew up in North Carolina. And Solace in this book is the one-word name for a hospice. So we are going to Solace in this book because we're taking care of, a host of characters are taking care of someone who is gravely ill.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very different people. We've got plain people, we've got fancy people, but their paths cross at Solace.
Plain people and fancy people, and we don't mean those who are tattooed and have...
No, in mountain parlance, that would be, you know, someone who doesn't come out of the mountains much. That would be your plain person.
Right.
And somebody fancy, somebody from outside those mountains.
Right, somebody from a big city somewhere.
Yes, exactly.
Some other place.
That's right.
That's right. There aren't any big cities.
Well, they've
what
heard tell.
What is the largest town there?
Where I'm from, I'm really near a fantastic city called Asheville.
Oh, I know that.
Way west.
You've got even wonderful culture there.
Oh, yeah. Asheville's, I cannot recommend it enough. It's really something. I'm from down the road,
mm-hmm.
but Asheville's where one goes for a little bit of culture. Yeah.
Very good. So now, for those of our listeners who really are not aware of what hospice is about, my understanding is that it's essentially an end-of-life care. It sometimes can be what they call palliative care, which means you have heavy-duty, pain-reducing drugs. But essentially, it's done in the last 6 months of life, often a much shorter time than that. And it can be in the person's home. It can be in a hospital-like setting, which is maybe how many people know them here, or similar to a group care home where you know, everyone has their room or they share a room with someone else and they get care from the nurses and staff who are there.
Yeah, that's right. That's beautifully described. It's my experience. I'm sure most of our listeners have had to deal with illness in the family at some time or other. In my family, it's happened in my life in several regions of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But in those mountains, and particularly back in the 80s, the book is set in 1989, hospice care there would come to your home. In
mm-hmm.
other words, you are assigned by a doctor to hospice care when it's really established that you're probably not going to get better. And as you say, that can go on for quite a while. And some people opt to stay home and have hospice nurses come to them.
Right.
In this part of the world, there are also, as you describe, almost literally homes they're home-like,
right,
where you can go somewhere and be cared for with nurses round the clock, but you're in a bedroom. These homes have kitchens. There's a real neighbor feeling in a place like the mountains of North Carolina. Again, certainly back in the 80s, which one might not experience in a larger setting somewhere else, some other part of the country.
This is what, 89?
89.
Right. So is there the same kind of care homes available back there today?
Probably not to this extent. I've been through those places, but visiting such a place
right.
isn't the same as
no.
needing such
sure.
a place. And I chose 1989 because I wanted the book to reflect a kind of crossroads. This is geographically a place in the country that is a crossroad because it's the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And so anywhere where you might live is a pinch point. It means that cultures are crossing those mountains. But also in time, in the 1980s, this is when healthcare workers who are coming to this part of the country might be coming from across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
This is when...
As your doctor does.
Right, indeed, Dr. Narduli. And where healthcare providers are dealing with illnesses like AIDS. So we've got cancer and we've got all kinds of things meeting.
Drug dependency. Hospice.
Yes,
yeah, or
indeed.
Abuse. Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So that interests me. It interests me about this part of the world, and it deeply interests me what it summons in human beings when they're in these really frightening situations where you're trying to help somebody,
mm-hmm.
and you're coping with things you've never experienced before, and you're meeting all kinds of people
right.
that you've never met
right.
before. And it impresses me how people handle that.
Well, it's very interesting. What you've done at the beginning of your book, which is something I haven't seen in many books recently, is you know, do you remember the old Agatha Christie where she used to list the characters at the beginning?
Yes.
And you've done the same thing. You've divided them into families, caretakers, friends, and loved ones. And you've got several families you talk about, the Earlys, the Dulls or Dulays, the Grevies. So which one – are there any that – are really familiar to you more than the others?
Familiar meaning coming from my own life?
Well, that would be a good way to look at it, sure. Or just someone you think you know or knew. In other words, did you see the characters as you wrote about them? Were they someone you already had a face attached to?
Oh, yes. No, I would say they're all familiar to me emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if you knew every inch of my life and you looked at those characters, you would say it would work like a mosaic where somebody smashed a lot of dishes and reassembled pieces. So there isn't any strong parallel over in those characters in my life, but there are aspects of those characters that I know very well.
Mm-hmm. So the Earlys. Tell us about the Earlys.
Oh, I love that you ask about the Earlys because August Early, who is one of these plain people,
mm-hmm.
August Early is a man who has quite a bit of depth. He hauled for a living, meaning he was a trucker.
Right.
And he's an older man. He's never been in even an elevator before, and now he's coping with grave illness. His
mm-hmm.
wife is ill. August Early was the first character who came to me.
Mm.
So he's dear to my heart. He led me into this book. And actually, his first encounter with an elevator is the very first thing I wrote. And that's not the first thing you encounter in the book now.
No.
So,
but it's in a good spot.
Yeah, you think?
I
oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm very...
If you'd started out with that, you'd have the, I don't know, the Hey Rube kind of
yes.
picture of him. And he's not like that.
No, indeed not.
Yeah.
He and his wife, Theo... It's been so interesting to me to talk to readers. I'm so familiar with certain kinds of people that you would bump into a lot in this part of the world. And this is a matrilineal world
mm-hmm.
here in these mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So the mother is the important person, the
Both,
land.
In fact, legally it's matrilineal.
Indeed.
Yes.
My father was always referred to as my mother's husband, which drove him nuts.
Right.
But this, his wife, Theo, some... people who've never been down to this part of the world see her as severe. I don't. She's economical with the way she speaks and, in fact, with her feelings. But, boy, these two people are married. That's a kind of love between these two people that It just moves me.
Mm-hmm. But they're also grandparents.
They are.
Which is fascinating. You know, it's written and said in 89, but it's so right on for today's world. So many grandparents have become, you know, the step-in parent for their, you know, their grandkids.
Right.
In this case, a pair of twins.
Right. Poor August has a real problem on his hands because their little ones believe that they are their parents.
Mm-hmm.
His wife's feeling is that she doesn't want to burden those children with the thought that their mother died because mm-hmm. their mother died from a drug overdose. So he has an interesting problem on his hands, August,
right.
as we go through the book.
And one of the things that happens is since you divided it up as the families,
mm-hmm.
but so much he has been the caregiver at the house
right.
for so long. Has come off the road to spend more time with his wife and take care of the little ones. And it's not a role that he thought he would ever fall into, I think.
Indeed. So this book is written in close third person. That means we're saying he and she, but we can't know anything more than that character knows. And when we're close into August Early's thoughts, it's interesting that he often has to think, what would my wife do? He learns from women's culture in trying to figure out how to do right by her.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he bumps into something that I think we all do, any of us who have ever been through this, is that the person who is ill is going to do it their way. And no matter what preconceived notions one might bring to this, one is always surprised. You know, there are some things asked of us, and there's some things where we're told to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And August Early has to find his way through all of that.
Exactly. So I think it's probably time for us to read a section. Why don't you give me the book?
Sure.
To find out. Because I want to – well, you've got some things marked.
Well,
do you have something you'd like to share?
No, not really. I would love for you to have a look and see what you think. Well,
oh, you started with that. So you have the elevator there. This is fascinating to look at someone else's thought process here. What I wanted you to do is start out with – we'll introduce another group of characters, the Dulls, D-U-L-L.
Yes.
Now – of course, when I read that the woman, the daughter who lives in Palo Alto, calls herself Dulay, I immediately thought of Hyacinth Bouquet in Keeping Up Appearances.
Well done. Yes.
And I wondered if there wasn't a little bit of – did that have any influence on deciding for that choice of how you call yourself?
Well, it could – mostly it's her – Dull is a name from that part of the world. And she was born Margaret Dull. And as she says, you're born dull, you change the name.
Right.
That was clear to her from day two in kindergarten. So she's a gal who grew up in the mountains and wanted to get out of there. And she dictated that to me. I mean, Maggie's a
– She dictated that to me. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, these characters, many writers, I'm sure you know, one begins to write and the character takes over. And mm-hmm. I didn't know Maggie when I started to write her. I certainly had no idea what would happen once we started her going home to help her mother. I didn't know how angry she was. I didn't know what she was coping with. That, it feels when I'm writing like it comes, the character speaks to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I discovered
that feeling.
I bet you do.
And it's really interesting because I'd done so much nonfiction before. Mm. And you'd done children's books before, so it's a different
mm-hmm.
format.
Mm-hmm. But I wrote a lot for theater, so that business of writing through a character was kind of, yeah.
Let's do the chapter entitled Coming For to Carry Me, which introduces Maggie Dulay.
Okay. And to set this up, because we are getting introduced to her, but the chapter before it refers to a Dr. Narduli.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that the oncologist who's helping those who are sick.
Well, we knew that from your list of characters, too.
And we knew that, too. Yes. Right. So we've heard his name, and then as we meet Maggie in this chapter called Coming For to Carry Me, here's what she says. We'll give you a little bit of this. It might be time for solace. That's what Narduli had said. Apparently, Maggie's mother was a candidate for in-house hospice care. Maggie hoped so because bi-coastal supervision was not an option. She got busy packing the trimmest of bags. Countdown to holiday hell, and here she was flying to the boonies. Not what you'd call a career booster, but then again, who was she kidding? Career? Hers was a job. Euphemized in the trade as event planning, it was in fact merely party throwing for the rich and incorporated. Indeed, years of professional festivity had eroded Maggie's sense of mission to sheer rent paying. Thank God for her access miles, considering the airline wouldn't see fit to stake her to a flight before her mother died when she could actually do some good. At best, booking at the last minute on Thanksgiving week, she'd have wound up paying a small fortune to ride at the back of the bus. But with her access status, Maggie popped into first class, no questions asked.
Right. So what she, you go on later in the chapter and you talk about how she calls herself Dulé with an accent on the final
right,
so,
as if
syllable.
French.
Right. And she talks about how she has to turn over her very, I guess she makes quite a bit of money on this, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. She's offering a $5,000 bonus to her assistant if she pulls off this party when she's away. But she's really not looking forward to going back. And the bi-coastal aspect of this is a constant problem. And I suppose what one of the things that's so marvelous about this book is how it puts a face on the process and decision-making that the boomer generation is going through now, starting. Some have already gone through it, where their parents have aged to a point where they're needing care, mm-hmm. or they may be at the end of their life and needing planning. And the real difficulty is how, even in this family, how she ends up as the daughter, even though she's in California, who goes to take care of it. And the brothers, well...
Not very useful.
Not very useful, no.
As we discover, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my heart goes out to all of us. I think we boomers think we're prepared for lots of things, that we generally got our education and we're somehow paying the rent, and then along comes a family emergency. How in God's name do we juggle all of this?
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes think about this book. I think one could make an argument that it falls into the genre of science fiction.
Hmm.
And the reason I say that is because, you know, that boomer who, again, feels relatively prepared for the world.
Assuming they're staying healthy and on top of whatever they have to do, right?
Well, they feel capable. And then the second someone's sick, much like a spaceship, suddenly hitting Mars.
Not just someone, but Mama.
And Mama, to boot, yeah. Someone we care so desperately about, and we're having to...
Or really have mixed feelings about.
Right. Right. Though in the end, you know...
No, let's not go to
we're not going
to
give that
no,
away.
No,
right.
We've got to get there in the book.
Right. There, as you say, complicated feelings, but a lot at stake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even with complicated feelings, we fight hard for those,
right.
to keep them going.
Well, one of the nice things about all three families that you do, there's not someone waiting in the wings, you know, waiting for them to die so they can probate the estate and take some cash and run and do something else.
Right.
These are all people who end up really significantly caring for their loved one.
Right. It's, you know, in my own way, it's a book about values. It's a book about neighbor. It's a book about it. It's a book that asks the question, what is family?
Mm-hmm.
And what is family to do? How does one behave? Some people do really beautifully. Some people have moments where they fail or they feel that they're failing, as
right.
do we all.
Right.
And one thing I love is that I think the character who turns out to be best prepared for things is a character one wouldn't ever guess would be well prepared
yeah.
for things.
Yeah.
So there are some nice surprises.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have a character in here named Candace.
Actually, it's Cadence.
Cadence, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
Like rhythm. Cadence,
yeah, I should
right.
have been reading when
no
I
problem.
Said it there. Tell us about her. We meet her. She's an eighth grader, and she's in the Rexall Drugs, as I remember when we first met her.
Right. Cadence we meet, and we get to know the way anybody would get to know her. She is in the eighth grade, but she's described as a 14-year-old going on eight. People refer to her as a big little girl.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in town knows her very well, and they say that her thinking didn't keep up with her growing. She does just fine. She has a little part-time job at the Rexall Drug. She's a scrappy gal.
Now, tell everybody about what she does at the Rexall Drug with the cards.
Yes. So she works for Mr. McCallum at the Rexall, and like any of those little hardware stores, you have to sell everything.
Right.
So she has been given a job, basically.
Rexall's a drugstore. It just ended up selling everything. Right.
But, in our neck of the woods, Rexall was on the corner,
right.
And it's where
it was the five and dime kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I have a painting of a Rexall in our neighborhood. But anyway, Cadence's mama asked Mr. McCallum, who owned the Rexall, if he could keep Cadence busy for just a little bit of money. So she comes in after school. She dusts off the chewing gum. She dusts off the kitty cat clock in the window, and she makes sure that those cards, you know,
that's
those
the one with the tail that goes back.
Yeah,
it
ticks back and exactly. Right. You're picturing that, and then she makes sure that the carousels that have the cards are in good order, and that the birthday card is in front of the envelope so that you can see it. And she takes immense pride in this. And then when she gets done with that, other than saying thank you to folks as they leave, she gets to do her homework.
Mm-hmm.
So the town takes care of her, and they've found a way for her to contribute, which is something that I experienced when I was, you know, in that part of the world.
Right.
And it's something that I adore, absolutely adore. I think it's wonderful. It has nothing to do with charity. People look for ways to keep people plugged in and helping. And that's what Cadence
is
doing.
It's neighborly, being neighborly.
It is being neighborly.
Right.
It's being community, you know, all these things that are euphemized or people are nostalgic about. I was lucky enough to be in such a place. And we don't use clinical words for people like Cadence. She's just different, and her thinking hasn't kept up with her growing. On the other hand, she's saddled with a mama who's really sick, and mm-hmm. she's the only child at home.
Right.
So she's coping with a lot.
And Daddy is somewhere up in Chicago.
Daddy's in Cincinnati. Her daddy's So Cadence is Cadence Grevy.
Right.
And Cadence could tell you this, and the reason she knows this is because she knows how it's written on an envelope. Her mama's Verlina Grevy, and her daddy is Bobby O. Grevy. But Bobby has moved to Cincinnati, yes.
Yeah. And he's there with his lover boyfriend, who is younger, I gather.
Yes. Yeah. Bobby lives up in Cincinnati with Paco.
Right.
And Cadence has been up there once, and they were really nice to her, and she loved that, and they have a grand piano in their house. But she didn't know any of the kids up there, so it wasn't the funnest summer she ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So she lives down in the mountains with her mama, and Bobby's up in Cincinnati, and of course, she's going to have to be in touch with her daddy about all this.
Right. But she has a phone number she can call.
She does, because she knows how that address book works, and she knows to look it up under B for Bobby, not G for Grevy.
Right.
And that's what she does.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her mother was working at another store, a very interesting store that sells primarily to the tourists.
Right. The Mountain Man store.
The Mountain Man store.
And that's also very typical of this area, might be of others, but Cadence has come to call the owners of the Mountain Man store, who are Pam and Walker Crow. She calls them Uncle Walker and Auntie Pam. Now, they're not her uncle and
right.
aunt,
right.
but that's how they treat her as really part of the family. And they were able to employ, this is how Verlina's kept food on the table, is they employed Verlina to help them with the Mountain Man store, which is one of these tchotchke stores, we would say, in our Yiddish, a wonderful little tourist shop, which probably doesn't have too many people walking through it in the winter and is just jammed in the summer.
Right.
And filled
with...
What's
their best seller?
Well, sadly, I think anybody from there would say this is sad, that their best seller would probably be the kind of cutesy watermelon painted maybe watering cans.
Uh-huh.
And rusty tools
right.
go for $1 billion.
Right.
What probably is overlooked now but was really big in the 60s, you'd have real Mountain Man stuff. You'd have piles of pelts from animals. You'd have bear claws, lots and lots of arrowheads, this kind of thing. There's less of that, of course, now, and tourists don't know what to make of all that.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 60s, that was a thing. And, of course, Cadence is very attracted to those older, realer things. And then there's a middle ground. There's a there are carved red birds there.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some hand carving stuff. And again, this really relates
really
to my experience
work.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But underpriced.
That's probably underpriced.
Yeah.
And those watering cans are probably overpriced. So God love everybody. I mean, the walkers have got to make a living somehow.
Yep. But not during this time, not during these this week. Before Thanksgiving, the tourists are long gone. They still open up every morning.
Oh, Lord. Well, see, Walker was hoping that they could just stop working.
Yeah.
Pam insists on coming down.
She has a real strong work ethic.
Ooh, Lordy.
That's Pammy.
Pam has a lot of thoughts about how things should go. She does a lot of bossing him around for other people, right? And he talks about how it blows through her, these moods blow her through her, like the way the storms come across those mountains. And all he's doing is trying to steer the rain away all day long. So he's trying to keep her happy. Yeah, for some reason, she gets it into her head that they should open the store before Thanksgiving when nobody would shop except at the grocery store,
right?
And thank God they do, because all kinds of things ensue because they happen to be in that store. But they don't know that.
I hadn't thought about that. If they hadn't been there, certain things might not have happened.
There's a whole lot of crossing paths, and paths are crossed at that store as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, let's go and look at the other group. We've got the families. We've got the caregivers, we'll call them, in the families, you know, who are the unsung heroes of anyone in their final days.
Yeah.
And then we have the professionals. And when I read about them, I kept seeing parts of the help. Was that intentional? Or had you seen or read that before?
How much do I love that you asked that question, Gil? I just want to say that, of course, I picture them. How people picture these characters depends on who they are. So you and I are Caucasian people, and we picture things a certain way.
Right.
I have noticed that people of color, and this I intended, as they read the book, they see people differently. I wrote the book in such a way that everybody's description, almost everybody's description, is very relative.
Well, you've got people describing about their flaking skin and why they're putting on, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
This doesn't have anything to do with it. It depends on who you are, how you read that. Thank you for pointing to that.
Yeah.
Somebody's described as the color of a wet potato.
Right.
Well, there are a lot of potatoes out in this
definitely
world.
Definitely kinds, different colors.
So the character who, because remember, we're in close third person.
Except that your language changes for these characters.
Ah, well, thank you again for pointing that out. That language is profoundly shared. In this part of the world, everybody speaks that churched way of speaking, even though, for instance, whites and blacks will tend to worship in a different church. They're not speaking differently at all. So again, it depends on who the reader is, who they're picturing as what, and I so intend that. I'm just thrilled that you asked that question.
My experience in North Carolina was that there were definite, when you went to get your tires changed, the man who sold you the tires at this time, about 1987 in fact, was white in a, you know, shirt with a tie, and the man who put the tires on was African American in a blue, you know, shirt. And this was in, you know, the Research Triangle, the Raleigh-Durham area.
Exactly, because that is Plantation South. Mm-hmm. And that, there's a different culture. I am very aware that this book sits next to The Help as an alternative. It's a very different world. Anybody who is non-Cherokee, who lives in the mountains, made a choice not to make a living much and just barely to get by, unless you were a logger. So it's an interesting set of people who are there, but any African American who's
white
there.
White pine forests?
Right, later on. And of course, most of that was raised. But subsistence farming is tricky.
Mm-hmm.
I lived right underneath the highest point east of the Mississippi, Mount Mitchell. So you get a cold winter.
Wow, you get to see a whole 200 feet.
Yeah. You're funny. What a Western guy.
Right.
It's not Plantation South, and you are just as likely to have an African American man selling you that tire. It's a complicated world. Right where I happen to live, parenthetically, is Blue State. It went Obama. It has different roots, and everybody there has different roots than those who owned that plantation and those who owned that slave. So that's another piece of a story that I'm interested in telling. It's damn complicated. It's not as if you're not living next to the Ku Klux Klan, but you might well be that African American running the tire shop. You'll notice, I mean, of course, I'm very careful in this book that those folks who are clearly described, like Dr. Narduli, mm-hmm. who is the best educated of anybody we meet, this man comes from India. Mm-hmm. And he is the person.
Well, it's a different kind of education.
And the folks from the mountains know
the
that.
Diploma's on the wall kind of education. Yeah.
And what we see in August Early, who you'd expect to have a problem with this, is that for him, which is what I experienced, there is a meritocracy. If you are the educated person in the room, you are the person he will follow. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where you're from. It matters how you're conducting yourself mm-hmm. and whether you're accredited, just as any preacher would be met with a great deal of respect.
Right.
So there's a code of respect.
Let's stop there. We'll come right back.
Yeah.
You are listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB-FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa. Tonight's show celebrates the upcoming Sonoma County Book Festival scheduled for downtown Santa Rosa Saturday, September 22nd. By having a conversation with the Petaluma author, teacher, and stage director Amanda McTighe about her debut novel based in the Blue Ridge Mountains entitled Going to Solace. We will close the show by talking with Ken Weaver about all the hard work involved in creating his popular Northern California craft beer guide. So stay tuned right here on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org.
We were talking about how I was really impressed with the fact that Dr. Narduli is obviously a fish out of water in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And no one that I remember in your book makes any, you know, the fact that he's obviously somewhere else, I mean a long way somewhere else,
yes,
is a big issue at all.
Isn't it interesting that it's Maggie who is the most sophisticated of the characters? She's the one who has to look the man up. And she has a few things to say about his accreditation mm-hmm. in India. And then, thank God, he also studied in Texas. So she's the least – she needs a lot of help to come to respect. Whereas for August Early, that he is the doctor. First of all, Theo didn't let him go into the appointments. When he finally meets him, he meets him in a hospital in that white coat, and he's got that beautiful British accent. He does note that.
Right.
August Early says that he speaks the way people do on television.
Right.
And those things cue him, and he's treated with a certain formality and respect that he understands, and so this is what he brings back to that interchange.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting, isn't it? And it is a part of Southern culture that is not told enough, I think. There's another side to Southern culture, which has to do with mutual respect, which mm-hmm. I adore. I absolutely adore it. And I hope we can bring it forward. And I hope those in the South that don't share it can be inspired by it.
Well, I'm delighted that you're showing a different part of what we know, we, meaning a Yankee, West Coaster, know of Southern culture, because it's so often colored, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah, with past history. And this is a whole different history. It's people, as you say, your people come from, you know, Ireland and the Presbyterian Scots background. And
Which was a poisonous mix.
Yeah, exactly.
So from that,
but I don't see that in the people in between the pages of your book.
Right. In this book, you feel people fussing with each other. They fuss a little,
mm-hmm.
but they're different. They overcome a sense of difference as long as there's a way in which people are dealing with them with respect.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I experienced. When people behave even that Klansman next door, you go along. When they misbehave and they get out on the street and start doing what they're doing, we step up and ask them to leave. And of course, I mean, I knew folks who I really did know people living next to the Klan who were on Klan watch. Mm-hmm. So they were basically listening by radio to what the guy next door was doing. So, see, it's a funny part of the world that's iconoclastic. It's about people who don't want to be told what to do, who get off in those mountains.
Well, that's definitely true. You
and
get
that yeah. And that's something 100%. They share.
Yeah.
Right. Men and women. It makes for an ornery set. But when they are in balance, they're not always, but when they are in balance, you
ornery
can't beat it.
Set. Let me think about that. Ornery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the nurses, the nurses fuss all the time.
Right.
And one of the nurses.
And the cook.
And the cook. Yeah. Right, right. One of the nurses says of another that, you know, she's the type that doesn't like prayer in school, but they get along with each other because neither likes to have someone tell them what to do.
Right. Oh, wow.
This is very familiar to me.
Very familiar. So tell us about where this book came from. What happened? You weren't a novelist. So when did you start writing this? You told me with the part about the elevator. But.
Right. There was one step before that. It really was a thunderbolt. I was actually out here working. I was working in theater. I was producing things. I was busy. And I was in the back of a car, kind of being driven somewhere, exhausted. And I had this picture of a woman on a mountain in a dress. Mm-hmm. And I had a sense that that was important, because I remember that. Well, sure enough, within months, that was me. I was suddenly not on the West Coast. I was on the East Coast. I was back in those mountains for family reasons. And my life got kind of split there. And
when is this?
That was 93, 92, 93.
So about the time,
just around
the time.
Right, about that time, right. And for various reasons, I found suddenly that I was living there. And that, I mean, that place is so rich to me. Mm-hmm. And I could take a breather. I'd been just paying the rent and a little bit Maggie life, you know, just driving. And in that quiet, and there's nothing like the quiet in the Blue Ridge, particularly in the winter when there's nobody around, and that snow falls and you can't hear a thing.
Right.
There's maybe a crow. That's it. In that quiet, this just began to sneak in, and I realized, oh, it would be so nice to not be writing dialogue. Let's just see. And I just started to write things down without asking anything of it. And that was quite a while ago,
as I'm telling you.
Yeah. So because I had to go on and make a living and so forth, I just kept writing and putting pages in a drawer, basically. I got to it when I could get to it, and it accumulated.
Were they like short stories or
they were.
Snippets or
That's
a diary or what?
That's an excellent question. They were very like short stories. In fact, I wondered if maybe that wouldn't be what I would have. You know, they stood on their own in a way. Mm-hmm. And again, they just kept piling up. But Gil, my God, it was so long ago. At some point, it must have occurred to me, wait a minute, I think I certainly felt the thread, but I'm not sure when it was that I started to hang it on this idea that we were in 1 week in Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And that was the tough, hard slog that any writer has, where you're trying to piece things together in a way that works really well for a reader and makes some kind of sense.
Right. Well, yeah. It's a wonderful, if artificial, constraint.
Right.
Because it has to happen in that time period, and there's one day one, and everybody knows the Thanksgiving week and what happens on Thursday. And so there's a familiarity. It doesn't matter where you are. And turkey has got to be involved somehow. In many different ways, in fact. It's strange and really weird West Coast ways. But it does.
We
it
won't
does
give
appear.
It away.
No.
Yep. No. Yep. Yeah. So it was long. And I like to tell that story because I know there are a lot of people out there who write a little bit here and there. I just encourage everyone to just keep letting it pile up. You mm-hmm. never know. Mm-hmm. I never, ever I wasn't aiming to write a novel. As there was more material, then I really began. Then I fell in love with these characters, and then I just so much wanted other people to know them. Mm-hmm. So that's what's been pushing
me.
Right.
So I understand another major milestone after you decided and you found a publisher for your book was when you finally saw the cover that had been done for it, because it's quite different than a lot of covers out there. You know, if you go to the bookstore and you see there's this, I don't know, similarity, I guess you'd call it, to them. And this is a house, obviously, I think Solis, isn't it?
It is Solis, indeed.
On a hill with the trees in turning color and the Blue Ridge in the background and clouds and a beautiful purple swash of color and saying, going to Solis. And anyone who doesn't know this just can see that it's a nice, friendly place to be.
It just brings me to tears to speak of how beautiful this design is. For folks who don't know, when you're published, the designer comes to you through the publisher.
Right.
And I have not met this designer, but God love her. She
read your
got
book.
The feeling. Well, she got the feeling.
Right.
It feels the way the book feels to read it. There's love in this image, and it's clear, and that's not easy to do in a single image. I'm knocked out. It's absolutely, and everybody says that. I just hear a kind of, oh, and it's beautiful and hardcover too. How lucky a girl am I? I can't believe it in a first novel. I'm so grateful. Maybe the designer is listening. I just want to say thank you so much.
Right. Well, I think you can probably find her webpage and make a comment or two.
I shall do that.
Now, what has surprised you about the response to readers? And I know I've been on Amazon and I've seen you've had quite a few readers' comments there, and you've been doing a few presentations of your book in other settings. You did a class or two. Did you assume you used your book in the class?
I don't know if I've taught with the book much.
I'm
coming to it a little, and I'm really grateful for this. I'm coming to it as the readers are. I've been kind of not close to it.
Because you've been away from it for
a while? I'm working on a second book, my head's in another book.
Yeah.
But coming back, oh, my goodness. First of all, doesn't it just touch you when readers tell you their stories? That's when I know. You know, when somebody reads your work and then they start to tell you, that is so happy-making.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked what was surprising. I get into the world of the characters, and so many readers speak about how they feel comforted. It reaches into their lives. That is something that I'm very happy about, but I'd kind of forgotten. The other thing...
No, wait a minute. Let's go back to that. You had forgotten that you were writing... Who were you writing to then? Did you have someone in or some
God, what a
group
great
of
question.
People in mind?
First
or just
person.
For yourself? Which is not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. I think I imagine... I think way underneath it, I imagine the folks that I grew up with in this North Carolina place.
Who are familiar with
it. Yeah, that they would smile and say, yes, this is okay. That this is, yes, this is fine. It is neither too close, and it is certainly not inaccurate.
Right.
So it depicts us, but with the proper distance.
Right.
I think I probably was hoping that's what I would hear from that reader. I think I've been afraid to think about readers who are all very, very different from this book. I've wondered whether it could have a reader who isn't from the region.
Very, very different. Oh, not from the region?
Yeah.
Well, having read it and not being from the region, that's not a problem.
Ah, you see, I'm... So there's a little... Not surprised, but I'm very happy.
I wrote, in fact, a comment on your Amazon page, and one of the things I said is I read over 100 books just for this show. And not all of them are well-crafted. But this goes beyond being well-crafted. It is a very emotionally fulfilling book to read.
Gil, can I just lie down now and just cry a little?
I don't have any Kleenex in here. I'd hand it to you.
Oh, I feel that way only because I still feel that way about these characters, that I've been able to make them clear to others in a way that's meaningful. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what we all do this for. It's just very happy making.
Right. There's a character we haven't talked about, the one who makes up, takes old phrases and twists them around in such a way that they become humorous but still work in the setting.
Yes, Maggie's mom. You know, madness and dementia can have a poetic piece to it, and I didn't want to stray into a sentimental place there, but Maggie's...
Stray into a sentimental place. This is something you were trying to avoid in the whole book?
Yes, because that doesn't do justice to this part of the world. This is not a sentimental part of the world, but this is a high irony part of the world. So this is a part of the world that will point out that really funny thing that somebody who was really sick said, mm-hmm. or that, you know, a malaprop that somebody had,
right.
and the way they switch their words and just laugh. I mean, my mother, who is not with us, laughing about her relative's letters to her trying to save her. I mean, there's a lot of ironic laughter in this part of the world. So they would enjoy a woman who was coming up with some funny ways of talking. Mm-hmm. Her brain is scrambled, but in an interesting way. And she brings levity to her daughter, this woman, Maggie, who's so uptight, and she's wound way too tight. Here she comes from California, and it's her demented mom who brings that Mozartian lightness of being to this dire situation.
Well, she comes with a tremendous amount of guilt.
Maggie does. The daughter does. Indeed.
Yes.
And anger.
And she wears it like it's armor.
Right.
And the mother doesn't help by saying, I don't even know who you are.
Right. And we won't give it away, but this mother goes through quite a conversion experience thanks to one of those nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And those two women end up, we'll see.
Well, the experience itself is something. That's where three chapters, as I remember. And and Maggie walks in the tail end of that.
Yeah.
That's quite a shock.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
It's hard. You know, you want to tell your listeners things, and we can't.
But, no, well, we could, but
well,
we don't,
I don't
want
to wreck
we
it.
Can't.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do that. So I'm going to – anything else you want to tell anybody?
This has been great. No, I would like to say that I would love to – if folks have things to tell me once they've read it, and particularly I'm interested in really diverse kinds of readers – there is a Going to Solace Facebook page where people can post comments.
Yeah.
And I'm really fascinated.
So it's SOLACE, goingtosolace.com?
Mm-hmm. Right, on Facebook. It's
Facebook.
Also .com.
Okay.
But Facebook is where people can actually just throw down.
You can see the
say,
whatever,
you know,
train of thought.
I hated this character.
Trends.
You know, I picture her as X or Y, or I thought he was this. I'd be fascinated in what readers think.
Fel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our conversation has been with Amanda McTighe about her amazingly rich debut novel about the patients, families, and caregivers in a North Carolina Blue Ridge Mountain hospice one particular Thanksgiving week in the book Going to Solace. It's a book I think you will truly enjoy reading. Now for something completely different, our next word-by-word conversation is with another writer who will be at the Sonoma County Book Festival, the beer expert Ken Weaver.
Ken received his MFA in creative writing from the University of Maryland at College Park and his MS in particle physics from Cornell. He has taught creative writing at Maryland and in the remote Mosquito Village in Nicaragua. Ken works as a professional beer writer and technical editor and created his first book, The Northern California Craft Beer Guide, with photographer Annalise Schmidt. Ken Weaver, I want to welcome you to Word by Word.
Thanks for having me, Gil.
Now, before we start sampling some brews, I need to get a couple of things straight. For example, I hear that your photographer, Annalise Schmidt, is somehow rather romantically involved with you.
we've been married for 5 years.
That would do it.
So, yeah.
So that was nice to work together.
It's been nice. We've gotten to work together on some projects sort of before this with mm-hmm. beer stuff. She works full-time as a renewable energy consultant. She goes by Allie for short.
Which is beer, is renewable energy, right?
You could probably do that. You could do something with biofuels, I think, somewhere in there. It's probably not going to be too terribly efficient. But
no, it's all that off-gassing that comes out.
You can make it work somehow.
And you're really an expert on this because I understand you drank a lot of beer in the interest of scientific accuracy.
It's good to be thorough. Yeah.
And that some are they connected to CERN, which, of course, everyone should know is the Hadron Collider in Switzerland.
That's the Large Hadron Collider.
Right.
It's CERN abbreviates to something in some other language.
But that's the one that we saw in the you know that movie about the secrets that were left in Da Vinci's paintings.
Yeah, there's not a. I was there for a summer. I studied there as a summer student, and there is not a dedicated. What is it? They had like some sort of spaceship. We don't or not.
No,
like
it
some
was
sort
in
of like
subterranean chambers.
Oh yeah, subterranean chambers.
Yes.
We sort of have that. They're not as sexy, and we don't have the sort of personal jet plane or whatever that was associated. At least I didn't get to
you
go
didn't
on
see
it.
It.
So I didn't get
you, of course, it could be there.
It might be there.
Right. I understand you managed to get paid to drink and write about beer because you bumped into Greg Kitsok.
Greg's got he does most of the stuff, beer stuff for the Washington Post. But he was also – I just met him at a beer tasting and sort of happened to meet someone else, like one of his editors, and she thought it would make sense for someone who's into beer and you know, into creative writing to sort of work with them and for the Mid-Atlantic Brewing News. So I was doing tiny
–
The
Mid-Atlantic Brewing News, is that a newspaper
it's,
or a
it's
magazine?
It's sort of one of those – it's sort of like a weekly – it's not a weekly circular, but it's the sort of the physical equivalent of a weekly circular. But it's part of – like there's all kinds of different brewing news, so they're all regional.
Right.
So we have like the Northwest Brewing News out here. Mm-hmm. And there's a Mid-Atlantic Brewing News and like whatever else, like, you know, probably –
So are there
lots of those things.
Craft breweries in the Washington area?
There aren't too many. Actually, D.C. is kind of
patchy in that
regard.
Obama famously ended up serving a bottle.
Yeah, I want some of that. I really want some of that homebrew. Okay, yeah. That's one of those. Yeah, that'd be kind of nice. But the D.C. doesn't have many breweries, but we get a lot of beer there. We get beer from because it's a
and you're not the only one who drinks it, apparently. Right?
No, it's – well, because it's an affluent area and because, you know, unlike – we get some cool imports out here. They get even many, many more.
Are we talking European or
– Primarily European.
Somewhere else.
Belgian, German, things of this sort, all that good stuff, all the European stuff. They get a lot of imports there. And in the surrounding area, in Virginia and Maryland, we do have some good breweries. I got a friend brewing up in Baltimore. There's a lot of good stuff going on out there. So we have the breweries on the periphery, maybe not in D.C. proper, and then lots of great imports and distributed beer from around the U.S. In D.C. So,
well, yours is called the Northern California Craft Beer Guide, and I was introduced by a friend of my daughter's who came up specifically to Sonoma County, started in Petaluma, went out to the river, went into Santa Rosa to try specific brews that you talk about in your book.
He is probably not alone in doing this. I know we currently live in downtown Santa Rosa, and we're in the process of moving to Petaluma. But really, Sonoma County, you know, when we have our beer loving friends, you know, travel in from a distance, you know, they'll fly into San Francisco, and if you're gonna leave San Francisco and go out for beer, you're gonna do usually three things. You know, one of three things. You go up to, you know, one sort of main thing is you go up to Sierra Nevada, up in Chico. I mean, the second biggest craft brewery in the country, and just making fantastic beer. So that's sort of one of those jaunts. That's an infrequent one.
Some people go a little out of the way.
It's a little out of the way. It's a good haul.
It's
from
a wonderful
San Francisco
park there. But.
It's beautiful, but it's a drive. The second thing that they also less regularly do is you know, they'll sort of do it, but it's not as exciting of a thing because it's just like you take the BART. But they'll go to East Bay. They'll hit up the beer scenes in Berkeley and in Oakland out there because you've got great, you know, some world-class beer bars and the Trappist and Beer Revolution right near each other in Oakland and some great breweries in Berkeley. So they'll go do that. They'll get on the BART and they'll go take it out there. But most frequently they will ask, all right, how do I get to Santa Rosa? Because they want to come to drink Russian River. And Lagunitas would be the other one that they would want to go to. Those are the two sort of calling.
Well, they stop on the way.
It's the two main beer destinations for a lot of people that are flying into San Francisco.
And people don't know Lagunitas is in Petaluma.
I think that it's – I know the people who know what Russian River is know where it is and know that they want to go there. And I think that tends to be – especially for the sort of, you know, up top echelon of beer geeks. Like they want to go – I mean they want to drink what Vinny's got. I mean everybody wants to drink Pliny the Elder.
Pliny the Elder apparently they stand in line for when it comes out?
It's the Pliny the Younger.
Oh,
it's the sort of the bigger version of Pliny the Elder.
What does it mean bigger?
It's higher in alcohol.
Not a bigger glass.
No, small glass, wisely chosen. And cause but it is like, you know, Pliny the Elder is about, I think, 8%. And Pliny the Younger, I think, goes between like 11 and 13%. So
wow.
You're talking wine,
yeah.
Wine
yeah.
territory
fortified
in terms
wine.
Of AVB.
Right.
Yeah, you're getting up there. I wish it was fortified. I wish the wine's getting so big too. But it is like, it's a delicious beer, but it's something that Vinny only makes once a year. It mm-hmm. comes out, you know, maybe basically the week before San Francisco Beer Week. And that's something that people know about. You know, everybody wants Pliny the Elder, the regular stuff. And when Pliny the Younger comes out, it's even bigger. It's more exciting. I kind of like it a little bit better. But it's only out once in a, you know, once in
so
a while.
So Sonoma County is sort of the place to go if you're into craft beer.
It kind of is. And yeah. It really is. I mean, and Northern California as a whole is – and we should get to that. But the Sonoma County in particular is something that you have Lagunitas, you've got Bear Republic,
right.
You've got Russian River, you've got Moylan's, you've got Marin. I could get most of the – I mean these are big. These are all – most of those are top 50, you know, in terms of size craft breweries in the country. I could get most of those beers out in D.C. when we were out there.
Uh-huh.
I was drinking Russian River. I was
yeah,
getting boxes
from
get Russian
the,
River.
Yeah, but you wouldn't get the little small releases that you can get when you come to the brewery.
I was actually able to get a growler of Pliny the Younger way
oh.
back in the day. So I had Pliny the Younger in D.C. I shouldn't say that because people get too excited. But it is like, you know, we could – this was before all the craziness. And we had – I've had growlers, you know, at our house in Maryland.
Right.
You know, we could get it before everything got a little crazy. So we were drinking Pliny the Younger at home, which you can't even do anymore for
right.
the most part unless
right.
you're really special. And I'm not really special.
But they put it out in those big bottles? I don't know what they're called.
The bombers. Yeah. Yeah. No, they don't bottle – they don't package it at all. So it goes to select beer bars and it's just on tap. And that's – and no growlers. They've stopped doing the growlers because it's just wanting to conserve it, wanting to – they do some really great stuff in terms of – wanting to support their local, like me, their locals
sure,
that are there
sure.
all the time. They want to have enough beer for them. So that's wonderful. I mean,
so you ended up basically you were writing about beer already, and did you come up with the idea, or did someone approach you and said, "Can you put this together?" Or how did you do it?
Our publisher approached us. I had met Chris from Cameron and Company, Chris Gruner. I had met him at actually the Sonoma County Book Festival. So I had met him, I guess they're 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had just sort of exchanged business card and had met in passing. I saw the West Marin Review and I believe what it's called. I think it's still – and they're still doing that because I believe he publishes it still. And it was something that I had heard about and I was doing literary fiction. So
mm-hmm.
I just sort of passed by and started talking to him. And he came up with a sort of core generative idea for the book and – had approached Allie and I about doing it, and it was, you know, a great fit. But it was definitely something that we took that idea, that sort of kernel of an idea, and just sort of ran with it with what we knew about the beer scene and what kind of book we thought would be best for this region.
Right. I know you're reading from your book or doing something with your book for the 10 minutes before
I think
do it.
Doing something
Redwood
with my book
stage.
Is about
yeah,
a good
yeah.
summary. I'm not really quite sure what that's going to be.
All right. And where else could they find you at the book festival?
So I'm going to be doing an event actually right after that. So it's – I guess I do the 3 o'clock thing at the Redwood Writers sort of circle or that mm-hmm. particular stage. And then I go across the street to – what is it? La Rosa?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the place?
Mm-hmm.
The Mexican food place on the corner. We're going to be doing – I'm going to be there with Daedalus Howell.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be talking about wine and beer in Sonoma County.
He was on this show a few months back.
Cool.
He wrote about Sonoma.
I have not met him yet.
Oh,
I'm looking forward to
book?
It. So I have
should.
Not gotten to it yet.
Yeah, it's fun.
A lot of fun. I'm looking forward to hanging out with him. So I think that's going to be a fun panel. But we'll be talking there from 3:15 to 4 o'clock.
Well, I want to pick up on something that you just mentioned is one of the benefits of going to the Sonoma County Book Fair, if you have any interest in writing, is the networking part. It's a wonderful opportunity that, you know, that was started a number of years ago and has continued on and is really a gem for the county. But he has written a flavorful and assertive Northern California craft beer guide. Name is Ken Weaver, and we thank you for being on Word by Word.
Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on North Bay Public Media, KRCB FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa. Tonight's show was a conversation with the Petaluma author, teacher, and stage director, Amanda McTighe, about her debut novel based in the Blue Ridge Mountains entitled Going to Solace, and with Ken Weaver, the author of the Northern California Craft Beer Guide. Amanda, Ken, and I will be at several venues during the upcoming Sonoma County Book Festival, scheduled for downtown Santa Rosa Saturday, September 22nd. This event transforms downtown Santa Rosa into the literary capital of the Northern California, with nationally acclaimed and locally treasured authors, including word-by-word favorites like Daedalus Howell, Jonah Raskin, Gay LeBaron, and Kara Black, as well as KRCB's own Catherine Hastings, Susan Swartz, and Doug Jane. In addition to a wealth of books, exhibitor booths, and readings to enjoy, there will be a panel discussions on topics ranging from blogging to book clubs, plus great entertainment for kids and teens. For the complete schedule, visit socobookfest.org. But I can tell you that Catherine Hastings will be reading from her new book of poetry, Cloudfire, on the poetry stage at 1:50. And at the Redwood Reading Circle stage, Ken Weaver will be reading from his craft beer guide from 3 to 3:10, followed immediately by me from 3:10 to 3:20 at the same spot, where I'll be doing a brief reading from my debut novel, The Marvelous Journals of Miss Virginia Pettingill. So drop by and say hello. Our studio engineer for tonight's broadcast is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We invite you to join us for the next Word by Word show, which, because of the presidential debates, will be broadcast at 7 o'clock Thursday, October 4th, when the tables will turn and I will be interviewed about the 15-year odyssey of creating The Marvelous Journals of Miss Virginia Pettingill by the author, journalist, and editor-in-chief of Harlot Sauce Radio, Patricia V. Davis. Until then, be sure to come to the Sonoma County Book Festival in and around Santa Rosa's Courthouse Square on Saturday, September 22nd. Complete information is available online at socobookfest.org.